It's showtime.
People pay good money to see this movie. When they go out to a theater, they want cold sodas, hot popcorn, and no monsters in the projection booth.
Everyone pretend podcasting isn't boring.
Turn it off.
狭い階段を上る。ドームの見える道。
知ってるのか。
いや、ドームは左側に見える。
ずいぶん昔のことだ。左かもしれん。僕は工科大学の学生だった。
裏切ったのは私よ。言って、あの人じゃないわ。すぐ行って計画を中止してちょうだい。
状況は一変した。
シュレーディはスパイの処分に関するもんだ。何が起こったんだ。
裏切り者がいた。
中止は不可能だ。同志たちは配置について。
行くわ。時間ね。
愛してるって言ってみて。
愛なんて初めから関係ない。
あなたはひどいことをしたのよ。
裏切ったりスパイになるというのはすこぶるセクシャルな行為なんだ。その時甘ったりしびれるような戦術が体を差し貫き。
やめてよ。
あなたは僕を呼んだ。なぜだ。
私を呼び止めようとしたのはあなただわ。
なんだって。
私をここから連れ出して。
ここから。ここは地下鉄のターミナル。誰でも自由に通れる。
私たちは今匿名で忙しいのよ。見て、聞いてちょうだい。私の娘は誘拐されて、奴隷にされて、競り売りされちゃうのよ。心配いらないわ。私も売られたのよ、16の時。でもそれは男たちにではないわ。革命に身を売ったのよ。今何時？
正午。
仲間は集まっている。ねえ、今何時？
1時。
私は喋っている。今、仲間は私を待っている。今何時？
3時。
彼らは行動を起こすわ。今。
3時半ジャスト。
本当の時間は何時なの？
時間なんてありはしない。
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me once again is Professor Earl Jackson.
Hi.
Also back in the booth is Mr. Axel Cohagen.
A pleasure to be here.
We continue our discussion of Japanese films this month by returning to the world of Yoshishige Yoshida and his 1970 film Heroic Purgatory. The film has been grouped with his Eros Plus Massacre and Coup d'etat as a trilogy, with this being the middle film. This is the Empire Strikes Back of the Eros trilogy. It's the story of Kanako, played by Mariko Okada. She returns home with a lost teenager, Ayu, played by Kazumi Tsutsui. Meanwhile, a man posing as her dad tries to get her back, causing Nakano's husband, Shota, played by Kaizo Komoda, to recall his youth as a revolutionary. Like Eros Plus Massacre, the film moves by its own logic, moving back and forth in time in order to tell its story. If you have not seen Heroic Purgatory, I think you'll be okay listening to this episode, as I'm not sure if I know what the heck is going on, and you may get something out of this discussion before you even start to watch the film. So Earl, when was the first time you saw Heroic Purgatory, and what did you think?
Okay, I think it was around 2005 in Seoul, and how I saw it is also, I think, important. I used to go to this great theater in Seoul called the Cinematheque. And for Eros Plus Massacre, It was in the basement of this contemporary art museum in this very upscale neighborhood called Angukdong. So that, probably my feelings about that film too, it was very pleasant to watch. But then the Cinematheque moved to the rooftop of a five-story rundown building that used to hold the Hollywood cinema. And to get to that theater, you had to go through an alley where every single shop was boiling pigs' heads all day. Yeah, I have always had to hold my breath just about a few meters before I walk through that alley. So you walk through the alley of boiling pig heads to get into this elevator. And the fourth floor was this thing that was called the Kolotech, which is like this dance hall for people over 60. So there'd be 70-year-olds dressed up in these outlandish costumes. And then you get up to the roof and you go to the Hollywood cinema. And that's where I saw Heroic Purgatory first. The first thing that struck me is how he used the screen space. That opening scene where most of the screen is part of the parking lot just completely won me over. It was drawn into that. And then every single shot is practically a new way of designing screen space.
And Axel, was this your first encounter with Yoshishita's work?
Absolutely. I was not sure what I signed on for. And I read the description on the IMDb and I thought, that sounds sensible. This seems like the kind of movie I'll be able to pick up on and figure out some nuances. I'm pretty smart. And probably about a quarter of the way through, I realized the movie was winning and it wasn't even close. Every time I thought I figured out and kind of nailed down a part of the cipher, something else popped out at me or screamed out at me, and I realized I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, it's a hard one. It's a real challenge.
It is dense. This movie is very dense. We talked about Eros Plus Massacre a few years ago, and I remember, like you, Axel, the movie won. It was like back when Mystery Science Theater, there was one where it was like Side Hackers, and I think Side Hackers won that episode because they just couldn't come up with enough good stuff. They were just stunned. I felt very much like that watching Eros Plus Massacre plus this film, even though this one, it's a lot shorter. And I would say, God help me, it's more straightforward, even though it jumps around in time. There are times where the characters will just say, it's 1989, or they'll say, it's 1952. And you can't really tell that it's 1989, 1952, 1960, 1970, because everybody is dressed pretty much the same way. There's not a whole lot of old person makeup, if at all. I know that there are a couple of characters that wear wigs through here, but you don't really pick up on context clues through this because it is so stark and it's just beautiful. It's a treat for the senses to watch this, but at the same time, it is very much a puzzle that I'm trying to pull apart while I'm watching this. And there are times like you, Axel, where I'm like, okay, I'm good. I got this. I know what's going on. I know this person's relationship to this person. All right, I got it. And then suddenly it's, who's this ambassador? What are we trying to do? What year is this? But I'm okay with that. I still just roll with this film. And that's the thing that I like about these Yoshida films is that there's such a wonderful look to them. And even though I could find them incredibly pretentious, I'm so okay just being along for the ride.
I think it's so great to just enjoy what he did with screen space here. In some ways, I think of this as absolute cinematic space. There's nothing that can be naturalized. It's like an extension of Antonioni's L'Avventura, where people pose around different parts of Rome. This one goes further because some of the ways the space is constructed really has no natural justification. It's much more experimental than his earlier work. And this is exactly the wrong film to watch as a first Yoshida film. I hope you can go to his earlier ones, like in the 60s. There's one called Good for Nothing. There's another one, Escape from Japan, that are far easier to watch. But having said that, I completely endorse this choice. It's just a little more adventurous.
I was definitely intrigued enough that I would like to check out more of his films. the visual style is just stunning. And I felt like a lot of the films I enjoy and directors I enjoy try for this kind of aesthetic and rarely achieve it. There were over a dozen times watching this film where I just proverbially took a step back and thought, that looks amazing. And yeah, you just want to capture that moment in time, but you can't because it's on to the next visual, on to the next moment.
It's true. And then to go back to one of the things you're saying about when they say it's 1980, there's another complication there, because when this film was made, 1980 was the future. So he didn't know about 1980 yet. He didn't know that there was going to be this amazing economic surge and then the bubble breaking. So that year has an association for us that he couldn't have anticipated. So there's a lot of things here that really make viewing a more participatory experience. If you want to get sense out of it, it's up to you more than that. He's done his job. Now it's our turn, I think.
Being a dumb American, I don't know the significance of 1952 when it comes to Japan. I don't know the significance of 1960 or 1970 when it comes to Japan. Luckily, there are things called books where you can actually read about things that happened in these years. It's amazing. We are coming into this film cold. Wow. What is going on? What's happening here? But then you find out, oh, 1952, there was this big treaty that was being signed. It's finally the end of the war, but America's going to maintain its occupation of Japan. 1960, a different treaty is ratified. Very raw deal for Japan again. And we've talked about these things before on the show because of the way that these treaties and the way that, and I really appreciate seeing America from the point of view of Japan and having these things reflected back to me as a dumb American and realizing just what the history was of this time and how the oppressed felt about the oppressors, which was really fascinating for me because there are so many movies where there are things going on in the background and you just may not know about it until you dig into the history of things. I'm trying to remember In the Realm of the Senses, it's all set around a very particular instance of time that was going on. And if you didn't realize that, maybe the front story wouldn't make as much sense if you didn't know what the backstory was.
May 1st, 1952 is a really big thing for the history of the Japanese left because there was the May Day riots and they used May Day to protest signing of that treaty. And this was one of the most violent police responses to a demonstration in the history of Japan. Over 2,000 people were injured and two of the participants were shot to death. The idea of Japanese soldiers turning firearms on the population by that time is really unusual. So that is a pinpoint. The other thing is that the occupation itself was a weird contradiction because they came in and they made what they call compulsory democracy. So that in itself is peculiar. But then they decided that some of the Japanese Class A war criminals weren't so bad because they weren't communists. So some of these war criminals were actually released from prison and they became Yakuza. And some of the Yakuza helped the U.S. load ships for the Korean War. So this is one of the backgrounds here that the U.S. occupation didn't just bring rationality and democracy to Japan. There was a major problems. They even turned a blind eye to the meth trade because they wanted to make sure that they had enough workers to supply the ships. All of that's the background to the May 1st, 52 thing. Then within the movement, though, there was a struggle between the Japanese leftist per se and the Japanese Communist Party, which was still in some ways trying to rationalize Stalin. So that division in the left is one of the things that Yoshida's talking about. Both Yoshida and Oshima were part of the left back then. And Oshima's film, Night and Fog in Japan, is his version of this, almost the same plot. It's his version of the division in the left and the aftermath of the failed response to the palace. The thing that they signed is called Anpo, which is a shorthand for the American Security Treaty with Japan. that's what they're both concerned with here. But anything that's a trauma, sometimes reliving the trauma doesn't result in a coherent narrative. That's one of the things I would say about heroic purgatory.
There are some times where I wonder, are these scenes a dream? Is that why time doesn't seem to matter, that we're seeing characters who might already be dead in the present, or maybe they're supposed to be dead in the past, but here they are in this particular sequence?
Yeah, some of our memories, yeah.
So much of this movie is, to your point, the whole idea of being so disillusioned about Stalinism, and now we are falling upon each other. So much of this movie feels like it's little almost show trials of the people that are in these cells themselves, and them falling upon each other and accusing one another of being moles or spies, and who knows what when seems to be a big deal as far as what motivates these characters to do what they do. And then you can never really trust what they're saying because of that dream logic. Sometimes there's this whole thing of the girl that our main character picks up, and this man comes in and he's, oh, I'm her father. And then the girl's, no, he's not my father. And it's, who do we believe in this case? And as the movie goes on, it's, that makes total sense that he's her father. No, it doesn't make sense that he's her father. And we're just being vacillated between the two as we go along. And we don't really know, I don't think, by the end, who she really belongs to. And there's one point in the movie that Axel and I were talking about yesterday where she gets replaced by another woman who looks similar to her. And I don't know if we're supposed to be confused by that or not, because I know I was.
Yeah, I think that the point was that this girl that's pretending to be Ayu is actually one of the double agents that is trying to put Shota on trial. Yeah, and that, I found it totally confusing too. And I don't know if you noticed this, but towards the end, when they kidnap the ambassador and his wife, the wife talks for herself, but at one point, they change actresses there too. It's actually Okada Mariko with the wig that plays the ambassador's wife for a while. And it's really easy to miss that, but he is not doing us any favors. We really have to watch carefully.
I felt like I was losing my mind during quite a bit of this.
But it happened so slowly because I kept thinking, I got this. Who's that? I've got this. Oh, no, that's that guy. Okay, no, that's the girl again. And I watched it the first time through and was terrified of coming on the podcast because this is the first time I've watched a movie for the podcast and really felt like I didn't know what to say. So I watched about half of it and I watched it without the sound or without the dialogue, just to see what I could pick up from the movement and focusing on the actors. And then today I watched it a full second time through and I definitely picked up more, but the more I know, the more I think there is to know.
It's a labyrinth.
I've seen it several times, but I certainly can't give you any total interpretive key. And I don't think that was his intention. Now, if you compare it to Night and Fog, that also is somewhat experimental. It shows a marriage between a leftist activist, a woman, and a former activist who's now a professor. But the marriage party, it's all on one long table facing the camera directly. And the camera keeps doing this weird clock-like tracking shot between the right half and the left half. But the man comes in and then accuses them of crimes, and then you get flashbacks that are natural. So the flashbacks there actually locate things that you can understand. This one's far more radical. But what's interesting is that this turbulence in the Japanese left caused both of them to make experimental films about the same trauma, although that one was made in 1960, and this one's made in 1970. But I think that's one way to look at it. I think one of the things I'd say is don't worry about it for this film, but please watch his other films. I really love him as a director, and I would definitely encourage people to watch earlier films. He was even a Shochiku director. He met Okada Mariko because he directed her 100th film, which is called Akitsu Hot Spring, which is a Technicolor cinema thing, very traditionally made and beautiful. This is 1962. So it would be good for you to go back. I think you'd be surprised how much easier he is to understand in those things. He's also really an intellectual. I've been translating his film theory, and man, he's really dense. But I won't quote that because this is not a lecture, but he is really a thinker. Unfortunately, he passed away 2 years ago. I met him once. I met him and Okada Mariko. I had dinner with them, which was terrifying, but he really is a thinker. He had this aura of the great thinker around him, and I don't think it was an act.
No, I don't think it is either. Looking at his work, I'm like, there's a lot of stuff going on. The person who makes something like this definitely seems to have much more substance than just style, but the style is fantastic. And I just love looking at this. And I think what you did, Axel, by watching this without the subtitles and just paying attention to the visuals a lot more, there's so many rhymes when it comes to these visuals. The whole thing of these gates that will go up, or like the blinds that will turn. And then you see things in the background of some of these shots so often. There's this big circular building. It looks like an oil tank or something. And we get that quite a bit. It's not an alleyway, but it's a long space. It almost looks like a ditch or something, but it's concrete on three sides of it. You get a lot of shots in there. I want to say at one point we get a woman's dead body in there, and we think that it's one person who has died, but then she comes back later. She's one of the ones who takes off a wig and says, oh no, I've been alive this whole time. But we do get this rhythm of these different places as well. And some of these different characters, like occasionally we'll get this filmmaker character who shows up, and he seems to be spying on people, has this camera that he's constantly shooting these folks with. And at one point, I want to say the ambassador, because there's two ambassadors, at least one of the ambassadors, when they say, what would you have wanted to do if you weren't an ambassador? He's, oh, I wanted to be a filmmaker. So I'm like, is that maybe this guy as a different version of this person? I'm not really sure. Or, of course, was this Yoshida, because he is a filmmaker and this whole thing is looking at these images. Sometimes we have images repeated 16 times on closed circuit televisions, and we get things also being shown to us, like, I guess it would be almost a blackmail, and that a few times. And there's one version of it where the woman, I think it's Ayu, that he's coercing into or caressing her breasts and all these kind of things. She's not even in it in one of these instances, if memory serves, because
that's right.
Okay. I wouldn't swear to anything with this because it feels like you're watching a dream. It felt a lot of times like I was high while I was watching this movie, even though I was totally straight.
Yeah. And the other complication there is that the guy with the movie camera and the sunglasses, that's Yoshida.
Okay.
He plays that guy.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the only time he's ever done that. I don't recall him in any of his other films.
I thought he looked very familiar, so maybe it's just like photos I've seen of him. And to go back to the framing and things, just, it is interesting. You're talking about how he's using Technicolor and the widescreen. This isn't 4:3, but it's pretty darn close. 1:1.66, 1:1.85 at the most. And all black and white. And you get those same frames that we talked about a lot when we talked about Arrows Plus Massacre, where you have just down in the corner of a frame, you'll have a person's face, or when they have a close up, half of their face will be missing. Some of these framings that they have, there's one sequence early on in the film all around. It looks like a drafting table, and the way that this arm, this mechanical arm comes out of it. Even when it comes to later on, some of the light fixtures that they have, some of these lamps that are on tables, the way that it bisects people's faces or will frame them inside of a frame, inside of a frame. Stunning stuff.
Early on, there's one that's shot from inside of a car outwards. And Ayu is outside. But then if you look carefully, you can see Shota's image in the rearview mirror on the side. These compositions are fantastic. that's what I take away from the film. And that's where the pleasure in looking is, I think, for this film, for sure. Which, again, reminds me of Antonioni quite a bit. But this is far more political than Antonioni was.
The effect it had on me with the just massive shots where the ceiling's taking up the whole top of the frame, or where something's right in front of someone's face, it made me feel like all of these people are very disconnected and cold and just unable to form those human connections. And I think it's, if I remember right, it's not until 30 or 40 minutes into the movie where you really see the married couple talking to each other without it being a shot and a reverse shot, or without IU being in between them.
Yeah, that is true. And just think, using such widescreen techniques and then not using most of the screen is such a, it's an amazing risk. I think the first time that's done is in 1929 with Carl Dreyer's the Joan of Arc film, because he actually constructed a set that was so large that the cast actually lived in it during the shooting, and then he never films it as an establishing shot. I think some of the things that Yoshi does here is every bit as radical as that.
It feels like these characters a lot of times are going to be crushed by the settings that they're in. There's one part in a warehouse where you just get two little people walking into this warehouse and just the rest of it around them, surrounding them. And it's just spectacular. And like you said, Axel, this whole idea of who's talking to who, who's looking in a mirror, looking at who, you get a lot of mirror shots in this. And also, I don't think that anybody trusts anybody else. It feels like everyone has their own agendas. Even when it comes to our married couple, I don't know if they necessarily trust one another. And then we have the introduction of this girl in here, which immediately sets the couple on edge. Even though at one point she's, oh, no, you're mommy and you're daddy, and you get a lot of that stuff. There's a really twisted scene at one point where she's talking with the wife and has a rope and eventually makes a collar and gives the wife the end of the collar or the end of the leash and is being led through this apartment. And that rope comes up a few times because there's that scene. There's Shota, I believe, hangs himself at one point. Don't worry, he's okay. And then there's even what I guess is a sex scene. And I thought that she was dead at some point because of this rope around her neck. But then when IU comes in and takes the rope off, she just wakes up and is okay. Constantly getting this rope through here used in different fashions.
And then also the language is weird because almost everybody speaks informal Japanese for the entire film. The only one that speaks formal Japanese is like the secretary and wherever that is that he works. But that without that, the Japanese like social linguistic hierarchies, you can't tell what their relations are because they all speak the same politeness level. It's really disorienting.
Something I would not ever be able to pick up on, but I'm glad that you were able to. I don't know what these people's relationships are to one another, unless they say specifically, this is an ambassador, this is the ambassador's wife. There's too many times I'm like, who is this person and how are they related to this other person?
Yeah. And the relationship that's established may only last for that scene too. It will change the next scene. But in some ways, this film is hard to talk about without stills. I hope your listeners are looking at YouTube for something for these things, because you can't really appreciate it without actually seeing the amazing look of this film, I think.
There's the whole thing, too, that Shota is a scientist. I think you mentioned that already.
Yep.
Is he a scientist of lasers, or is he a scientist of nuclear bombs, or is he a scientist of both?
Both. In some of the interpretations said that he works for the Atomic Energy Commission, but I don't think there is one in Japan for obvious reasons. But I love this one line that he says is that if you hit this material with the lasers, you get a 3D space, but we can't get people to enter it. I think that's very interesting. Yoshida also did a whole series of documentaries about Western painters, Bruegel and stuff. They're really interesting. But one of the things that I translated, he said that the way he looks at paintings is, what's the frame of the painting and what is your point of entry? And in some ways, I think this film needs both a frame and a point of entry. His other films, you can actually identify it, like with Akita Hotspring, it's the end of the war and figuring out that the emperor is human. That is the point of entry for that film. And very clear. Here, we can't tell. I think it must be the trauma of 1952, whereas with Oshima, it's the trauma of 1960.
I feel pretty bad by saying that there is the actress that comes in, and for me, she gets lost, and I think that she's Io.
I think she's awful. Neither her nor the guy that plays Shota ever appears in another film. I think that they were amateurs. I think they just found them or something. But this is an art theater guild film, which is one of those independent high art things. And they never seem to really care about acting quality. And in this case, I don't see a lot of acting going on in this one. I know that sounds a little petty, but Kata Mariko she's one of the last classical Japanese actresses left. She was in Ozu films and everything. And she doesn't get a lot to do in this film at all. But yeah, I think that Ayu is really a placeholder and she disappears after this film.
I have to say, I took a liking to Shota as a character because he has what I'll refer to as George Clooney smugness when he's standing there watching these scenes. And to me, it felt, and this may be obvious, but here's a man looking at his life out of joint. He's looking at things that have happened or will happen to him. And his whole demeanor is this sort of wry distance from it. Like he almost can't be bothered with his own life. He's so disconnected and scientific and aloof. And for me, I thought that worked.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a really good observation. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but yeah, he has a very different relationship to the narrative than others. Yeah, and he's the only one that seems to have any charisma at all, I think.
It is tough to even tell, is he our main character or is it Nakano? Because even though she does disappear for times, he will disappear for times as well. And to your point, she is the best actress in this whole movie. And so she shines every single time she's on screen. I would rather have her be on screen every single moment just because she's so intriguing.
Watch her in Akita Hotspur. She's absolutely exquisitely beautiful. I think she's one of the great beauties of Japanese cinema, along with Wakao Ayako and Yamamoto. Oh, I can't think of her name now. It's so embarrassing. But there are several people who are just stunning. And Okada Mariko is one of them. She is getting older already by this time. And this performance is a bit reserved, but her screen presence is really quite phenomenal.
My theory on the star of the movie is that the star, quote unquote, was the couple, the marriage. And for the first half of the film, it focuses on the narrative structure and Shota, and he's the main lead. And then as it gets to the end of the film, it transitions more to the personal and the emotional and the symbolic. And that's when Nakano, that's when it becomes more her movie. So I think it's about the things that they symbolize as a couple that should meld together, but in the movie they never really connect.
Yeah, that makes sense. And she stars in most of his films after 1963 or 4. They married in 1963, and she actually funded a lot of his films because she was an extremely successful actress and was still doing major television roles. And that she'd do that to fund Yoshida's films because he, as you probably wouldn't be surprised, had trouble getting funding for these movies. he left Shochiku. Both he and Oshima were in Shochiku early in the 60s, and Shochiku decided to allow young experimental filmmakers, but Shochiku pulled Night in Fog in Japan after 3 days, and Oshima was so mad he left Shochiku. Same thing happened a couple of years later with Yoshida. He made this interesting film called Escape from Japan, and at the end, the protagonist ends up in a mental hospital, but for some reason, Shochiku cut that scene without telling him, and then he got really angry. He also left. They both have their origins in studio, and his is even longer because he used to be the assistant director for Kinoshita Keisuke in the 1950s. And then with Okada, that's so amazing because she was really one of the established institutional stars, and she left it all to be in these experimental films. Is astonishing to me. It still astonishes me.
I want to sound like a total hipster and say some people can get into their A24 films, but I'm all about the ATG films because I think that the Art Theater Guild funded some weird shit, man. And I just always enjoy whatever it is.
Just amazing. Yeah.
Everything that I've ever seen that has been released by ATG, I like it.
Which ones did you like?
I love everything that Terayama did. I want to say that some of, oh gosh, Human Bullet, wasn't that a ATG film?
I love that film. That is one of the best anti-war films I've ever seen. That is so great.
There was a time of my life where I would just look for ATG films and try to track these things down just because I knew every single time it was going to be something challenging and something, if I didn't enjoy it, I would at least be happy that I had seen the film.
Like Death by Hanging, Oshima's film about the Korean guy, that's ATG.
Can't say that I've seen a ton of Oshima films, but that is definitely one of them. And I think that I really go towards that era of his career more than anything else.
There's even a gangster film from ATG that's very different from anything else. Nakajima Sadao was one of the great gangster directors, but he made one from ATG that is so weird. It's called Aesthetics of a Bullet. I highly recommend it, but you've never seen a gangster film like this. I don't know how they did it. That's true of all ATG, but when they actually moved into genre, I find that really interesting. Realm of the Senses ended up being shot in France because every time they tried to shoot it in Japan, they were raided by the police.
Yeah. Which was weird that there was that movement of, because I know Terayama did, Story of O was... Or his version of that was also a French co-production.
The French loved Terayama.
Oh, who doesn't?
Yeah.
Other than his own mother.
Yeah, she has reasons.
He only murdered her in film so many times.
Yes. But then she comes back. She is like one of those imaginary murders. Yeah. Like in Farewell to the Ark. And what's the other one? Yeah. A couple of those. I love those. I recently tried to show one to my graduate students and they couldn't stand it. They thought it was too obscene. That, my God, what is wrong with students today? They've never seen a body in a circus before. It was so amazing to me.
I'm sure people would be just horrified by Emperor Tomato Ketchup these days with all the child nudity.
Oh, I wouldn't show that. I definitely wouldn't show that. No, that's a headache I do not need. No.
I have yet to see, so I'm going through these Yoshida, this trilogy, very deliberately. So I have yet to see Coup d'Etat, but I hear that it might be easier to understand than Heroic Purgatory, and I found Heroic Purgatory easier to understand than Eros Plus Massacre.
Oh, I found it just the opposite, because I know the story of Osugi Sakai, the anarchist, and Ito Noe. Those are the two people who were murdered by the police. That's a true story. In 1923, with the Great Kanto Earthquake, the Japanese used that as an excuse to violently put down the foreign resident population, especially the Koreans. That as many as 1,800 or even more Korean residents of Japan were probably murdered by the police and then dissidents. And Ito, Osugi Sakai, and his young nephew were all strangled. That's true. And Ito was a feminist and a writer. rather amazing. So when you know that story, that's easier to follow, because he even though it goes back and forth and it pretends that she survived for a minute, but there is actually a guideline in that in that film that there isn't in Heroic Purgatory.
I wish you were doing the commentaries for these, because I know the commentaries that are on the nice box set that was released a few years ago. For a 2-hour movie, the guy talks for 40 minutes. And I'm like, really? There's so much you could be talking about. Our conversation right now has been 40 minutes long, and we barely have scratched the surface. But we would have already put things in more of a historical perspective than I think that this gentleman did. And it's, give me more. There's got to be more to these movies.
Yeah, but that's really hard to do. I did one of those. I did the commentary for Masamoto's A Blind Beast, and it's really hard to keep talking. And it, you not only have to keep talking, but you want to make sure what you're saying is relevant to the scene in question. Sometimes I give them a pass. Although the ones that I think are really crimes against nature is when they do a anime and the people who are doing the commentary are the American voice actors. That's just ridiculous. But it's really hard to keep talking. I'll tell you, I wouldn't ever do a full-length one again. I do video essays for Arrow Blu-rays, but boy, is that a hard thing to do.
I know that pain. I think I could find more than 40 minutes of material to talk about this film, especially if I had a nice long conversation with you around some of these historical events, because I don't know those things. There were some resources where I was able to say, okay, what, 1952, what's going on? And so much stuff doing around these treaties. And even when we watched Battles Without Honoring Humanity, that is so much about the relationship between Japan and the U.S. And there is talk of Anpo in there. It's the background to so many of these movies that otherwise you would just be like, oh, that's a movie. And it's, no, there's this whole world outside of it. They are reflecting the times.
And this one's about Hiroshima. Remember, a lot of it takes place in Hiroshima. And there's 5 of those films. I think that's one of the great contemporary documents in cinema history. A lot of it's, and the other thing that's wonderful about those 5 is that they'll kill off a character and then they'll rehire the actor for the next film as a different character. There's something so jarring about its relationship to identity that I just love that. There's a lot of complaints about that very thing, but I absolutely love it, and perversely.
That's what I was going to say earlier, is that I felt a little bad because that I was mixing up the one actress with IU, and that I really was taking her to be the same person the whole time. It took me so long to realize, oh no, there's a different actress that's in here that also has this long hair. And when I watch it back again now, having finally realized that, I'm like, oh, that was so offensive that I thought they were the same person, but that's just the way that I took it.
Oh, I did too. I thought so too the first time I saw it. And she has a very different personality, but I think we're supposed to think she's the same person.
Okay, good. I'm glad it's not just me then.
If you look at it, the characters' personalities change on a dime, regardless of who's playing them. And the movie has a lot of people in the shadows or in bright spotlights. And in the beginning, they did a very nasty trick. I think it's very cruel if a filmmaker introduces a main character in sunglasses, because that means later on when I see them without the sunglasses, I won't recognize them. I would be fooled by Clark Kent, I realized.
I think he looks much better in glasses, actually.
We talked about the framing, but we didn't talk about the camera movement. And that's either actual dollying, tracking shots, and they do a ton of them. There's also a lot of great just pans and tilts going on. And then the use of the rack focus. He is rack focusing crazy, and it's always so interesting to see. It's to the point where sometimes characters will go out of focus so much that they don't even exist anymore. It's almost a transition. And then he loves the fades to white. When we get white things in this movie, I'm thinking of the wife's white coat that she has with black buttons. it almost glows. It is so white. And then when we move to the outside world, there are so many times where we just get completely washed out with white.
Or like the lens flares when during the interrogations, when they turn the lamp on people and it screws up the light meter. I love that. There's one scene where there's a close-up of Okada's face where she puts her hand on her face and you can see these nails. Her nail polish is like shiny and she has this shiny square ring on. Just those moments alone are just terrific in just terms of cinema working.
I have to say I'm a little jealous of you having been able to see this on the big screen because, again, even though I don't understand everything that's going on in this movie, it just washes over me in such a pleasant way. And to see these images projected so large, I think would just be such a treat.
Yeah, you really have to. Yeah. And also in coup d'etat, they do a lot of empty screen space too. There's a scene where this right winger has copied a sutra and he's sent it to the imperial palace. And the messenger brings back the response and it's in this huge box and it's not a scroll, but it unfolds. It's this big white paper and there's nothing on it, which is an insult. But while he's unfolding it, it keeps taking up more and more of the screen because it's white until there's only the top of his head left and the rest is white paper. Things like that are just so Yoshida at this period. But on big screens, these are utterly overwhelming. In fact, they almost intimidate you into not trying to figure out what they mean because it's bigger than you are.
I feel that. I also appreciate, too, the use of audio. So often he will just completely take audio out other than just sound effects, the sound of people walking, or he will add music. We've got some diegetic music in here. We'll call it music, where it's people sitting on a piano and playing the piano with their feet, and it just becomes this real discordant, awful thing, but it just keeps going on. And then other scenes, you have this ethereal choir playing, which really matches well with what is going on screen, especially when it's the people turning on each other. And there's one scene where everybody's pointing their fingers at Shota and just accusing him of being the traitor before he ends up hanging himself. It just works so beautifully.
Really redefines what coherence is. And it teaches us to be more tolerant of lapses in coherence.
I definitely think this is a film where I want to talk about sex and sexuality, because from the reading I did, some of which you sent along, Mike, and then from watching it, and that's my background anyway, this is a film where sex and sexuality is not able to be separated from politics and class. And your identity for these characters, it's very much based on where they are at, and there's a thrownness to it. They were just thrown their position in life, and they can be married because they have the money and they have that stability. When they were younger, they were the revolutionaries. And there are a couple lines in there, and I think this is maybe problematic in 2024 in some ways, but I think there's also some interesting aspects of it, of the idea of being gay or lesbian being a political decision. And I know there's a wealth of writing about that in gender studies too, the idea of not behaving like a traditional family as a way of showing that you were truly free. I think at one point they ask the ambassador if, in their words, homosexuality was a new way of being free.
I laughed at that one. It was, and for men, right? It said, do men become homosexual to become free? I thought that was extraordinary. It was a really funny line. And then also that strange quasi-lesbian boss when Ayu tries to leave for work early, that's also comes out of left field.
It's like a rape scene that's going on. And I love how that's shot through the camera viewfinder or camera screen from the old school television cameras. That was great.
That scene was a little problematic for me in that I felt they were adding sinister lesbian character to the film, and they didn't do as much with it as I were hoping they do. That character, what was her name?
Sometimes they call her Onko, and then there's another name too, but Onko is also an incredibly weird name. I've never heard that name before, but I can't remember her other name, but yeah, Onko is one of the names they call her, but that's not the same woman.
Okay, then that changes my reading of it, because I was under the assumption they were the same woman, and I was waiting for that to play out. I thought Onko was a really interesting character in that she pops up from time to time and pushes the narrative forward. But if I remember right, she was caught and tortured and then returned. So as a character, she goes through this, there's this interesting arc of her life, but it's all in the background.
Is Onko the one that you're talking about? Is she the one that's, it looks like she's attacked by five or six guys that have her down? Okay. That same type of pit, but not the same pit that I was talking about before.
Yeah, that was creepy. That was so creepy. But women had a very strong role in the Japanese left, especially later with the Japanese Red Army, when there's several major women leftists still in prison for the crimes of the Japanese Red Army. And there's whole books written about those women. It's weird. It's a strange, there's actually even a one on in English called the Co-Ed Revolution. This is one of the places where women found avenues to power really fast in the Japanese left. They also committed heinous crimes too. So I think that her, especially when she keeps saying, we must go forward, we must go forward, I have to get to the station now. That is very much how women are portrayed in the historical reconstructions of what happened in the leftist movement there.
There's a moment where she's given a monologue and it's her in the middle. And I think it's one of the ambassadors, on one side and another older gentleman on the other side. And then they're reflected up as well. And they're in front of a movie screen. And so their shadows are against the screen and their reflections are there. Who would even think of a shot like that? It's so gorgeous.
These setups must have been really fun to make. The cinematographer is also the same one for the other two films in the trilogy. I think that's one of the things that makes it a trilogy is this the look that the three films have, which is very different from his other films. His other films usually are more classically constructed.
I mean, I love good framing. That's one reason that I love Kurosawa so much, is that he always knew how to frame a shot so perfectly. And these are just studies in unusual and interesting framing.
Yeah. Also, how to make something interesting with no budget. This is a very low budget film. So I think they depend on the peculiarity of the architecture that they found a lot. And it really almost looks like a science fiction movie. It looks like Alphaville. Remember Godard's wonderful thing about Another Planet, which is just a neighborhood in France.
It really reminds me a lot of last year, Marienbad too, I think with the stark black and white, and just that there are so many times, I guess the moving camera also helps out quite a bit. And also the dense dialogue where it's tough to get a beat on what's happening.
Yeah. I think the comparing it to last year, Marienbad is actually a really good thing to do, because we watched it and it really doesn't bother us as much that we can't tell what's happening in some ways. It's such a gorgeous film. In some ways, European films get away with more than Asian films would, because there's a tradition of us, of the West, looking at Asian films as just cultural information. And this is definitely not what Yoshida does.
And that serves as my regular reminder that I actually need to cure my blind spot and watch Last Year at Marienbad, because it's been on my I need to do this list for a long time.
I'm going to completely disqualify myself here now, because when I was 15 years old, I found out that film was going to be shown at the University of Buffalo. So I took two buses there to see it for free. And I loved it so much, I walked all the way home and I went back every night. It is the turning point of my life. So at 15, when I saw that film on screen, it just seemed like there was a different way of relating film to the world. I absolutely loved it. Then when I went to my first year in Minnesota, I had a friend, I was taught in Minnesota, and he said, oh, what film can you recommend? It? I recommended Last Year at Marriott. And then the next day I got a message in my voicemail that said, Earl, do not ever recommend a film to me again. And he hung up. That film is very special to me, both as a revelation to me, but also to a warning to others that you may not want to take my recommendations.
I highly recommend starting up a podcast about movies and then making a list for yourself of things that you've never seen, but really should see. Somehow that's how I end up seeing a lot of these movies that I've never seen. And that's a really one of the reasons before we started recording, Earl, you had asked me why this one in particular. It's a challenge. I am challenging myself with some of these. I saw Aerospace Massacre. If I didn't have to watch this and watch it several times and read about it and do all this, I probably wouldn't watch Heroic Purgatory. And there's a lot of movies that I probably wouldn't have watched for the show, but making myself watch them is hopefully making me a better person.
I also give myself permission not to watch a movie. I have never seen Oppenheimer, and I'm completely comfortable with that. You know, I won't watch a movie where I know the dog is hurt or killed. I've never watched a John Wick film. I'm completely comfortable with that. I want to guard areas of my unconscious. I don't want those films occupying that.
To give you a little bit of context to how I found this movie, I want to bring up, I have a 7-year-old daughter, and so I don't get to watch as many movies as I used to before I had a kiddo. And a lot of what I do watch is skewed younger. So I'm used to watching cartoons and TV shows aimed at kids, and going from those things to finding myself halfway through Heroic Purgatory was like when it's a nice day out and you jump into a cold lake. It was a big change of pace.
Ultimately refreshing, or?
I liked it. I'm glad I watched it. I'm even glad I watched it twice. I think, Earl, you had said that it pleasantly washed over you, and pleasant wasn't my experience with this. I felt very nervous about this film. It reminded me of, not to sound terribly pretentious, but Sartre and Camus and Kafka, and this idea of yourself and your identity being on trial, fighting for existence. Here are these people who are confined by not only who they are, but society and economics and politics, and overdetermined in all of these ways, trying to make the right decisions. And I felt, and for me, the movie really culminated with the hanging scene, which it got a jolt out of me when you see Shota walk up to the gallows, they put the noose on him, and you see the shot from behind, and he jerks up. Just that one small difference from everyone, I'm assuming, expects him to drop down.
Yeah.
And that scene to me was, this character has gone through all of these memories and these ideas, and tried to connect with his wife, and tried to connect with Ayu, and tried to be a revolutionary or a counter-revolutionary. And at the end of it, he's found wanting and agrees to his own death. And then after that, the last half hour for me is Nanako coming to terms with how she feels. So it's like the language is gone, and now it's the language of pure emotion.
These scenes of people almost shooting each other, not shooting each other, a lot of guns being pointed at us, the audience, and we get faked out at one point with a gun. And then when I see a gun again later on, I'm like, oh, no worries. There won't be any bullets in there. There were. There definitely were. And we get to see a character die a pretty bloody death.
Yeah. For a while. Then they come back. Yeah, everything's in brackets and in parentheses in this film.
And you get the recurring thing of the paparazzi going through here, or the reporters, and even to the point where we have a reporter who is introducing a TV show or signing off from a TV show. Like, oh, you've just been watching this. And then the ambassador's wife comes up and just like, no, that, and takes the microphone away and just takes the power from him. So I guess going back to what you were saying as far as the power of the women in this film.
Yeah. But these, the whole idea of paparazzi in Japan, that also has a terrible incident that happened around this time. There was a gangster who had decided to turn evidence against the gang, and he was out on parole or whatever, but he was under guard, but he was essentially de facto guarded by the paparazzi because they were around his house. But while they were around his house, a black car came up and people came out with guns, went into the house and killed him. And then the paparazzi just filmed it and then filmed the escape. That really happened. And there's something very ominous about these people with cameras in this film. This had already happened by this time. There's a film about it that I highly recommend. It's called We Don't Need No Comic Magazine, that takes on that case. But Yoshida would have been very aware of that. So in some ways, I think these people aimed with cameras are just another way of aiming with guns. The anybody that's up on like scandals or political scandals were really hunted down by the cameras of the press. Then in Masamoto Yasuzo's brilliant film, The A Wife Confesses, how the cameras hunt her because she may have killed her husband. I find the cameras in the film ominous.
Two MacGuffins in this movie that drove me absolutely bonkers trying to ferret out their meaning. And maybe there is a deeper meaning I didn't pick up on, but number one, it drove me nuts that they tried to kidnap Ambassador J and got Ambassador M. It was such a specific detail that I kept expecting something to come out of that. And the other one is, and this probably comes from having grown up on too many American sci-fi movies, the discussion of the weapon. And the weapon must go to the agent at the station, and they must meet at 4 p.m. and the weapon will be exchanged, and the weapon needs to be there. And so I assumed that there was going to be some symbolic revelation involving the weapon, and all we see of it is it falls into a toilet and never gets delivered. So those were two places where I was expecting that I would find a payoff or a key. And I was, in my opinion, I was deliberately thwarted.
Yeah, I don't understand who the Ambassador J was either. M is definitely the American ambassador, that's for sure. But I don't know who Jay was supposed to be. Because Japan was not paying attention to anybody else's country again, other than America, unfortunately.
Yeah, I noticed that thing about the weapon, and I was just like, is that it? Is there going to be more to this? Because it just falls in the toilet. And then that started me on this whole rabbit hole of, do Japanese people have Western-style toilets, or do they have the same types of toilets that they have in China, where you just, it's the kind of squatty potty?
They both exist. They're both, you see both. If you go to a public restroom, they're marked on the door which one they are, so you always have the choice.
Are you good at squatting, Earl?
I had that. That was my toilet the first time I lived in Japan in my apartment. It's, you get used to it. You get used to everything. That's the secret of learning a language. You get used to everything. It's amazing what you can get used to.
I was very fortunate. I never had to worry about that when I was in China. I don't know if I was just going to the right places or if Shanghai is just so westernized. I know at the movie theater, they had urinals, but then if I was to go into the stalls, they had the floor ones. So luckily, I was just using the urinal at that point. But my wife was having a hell of a time.
the worst thing I saw was in Mongolia, where you go into a restaurant's bathroom and they might have five toilets there, but no stalls, just right, five toilets right there next to each other.
At least the people in the East have the full length bathroom doors, which I don't understand why they don't have those over here.
It does make a lot more sense. Yeah. In women's bathrooms in Japan, the stalls play music because they don't want that urine. People try to record the sound of urination. So they defeat it with like waltzes.
How much of Japanese culture, particularly around the time this was made, would have been well-versed in Western psychoanalytic theory? Or would that have not been something on the forefront of the filmmaker's mind?
He read Merleau-Ponty in French. Now, the Japanese have constantly translated Western works from about 1870. By 1920, there was a complete Japanese translation of the complete works of Hegel. There isn't one yet in English. So the cosmopolitanism of the Japanese cannot be overestimated. They would be very aware of everything. But in saying that, doesn't mean that they copy it. It means that they metabolize it. Yes, he would be very aware of it. Yeah. But he was more interested in phenomenology and in politics. He was much more interested in the construction of space in the mind. But I don't think that you can't be in the 20th century and pretend that Freud didn't exist for sure. I actually am a big Freud fan, which may disqualify me too. But anything that we're aware of, the Japanese are aware of in spades. No.
That makes a lot of sense because I wasn't getting much out of it, thinking of it from a psychoanalytic reading. And it makes sense that his vein was more phenomenological and political.
Now, remember, this language is so hard to read that seniors in high school are still learning to read it. And even then, Japan has a 98% literacy rate. Just think of that. So they really know what they're doing.
Who would have been aware of this movie in the United States? What was its path, or has been its path, to American audiences?
International film festivals, so like the San Francisco International Film Festival, and also a couple of the wonderful art theaters in New York. The theaters in Manhattan that would regularly show Godard would also be showing Yoshida.
The reason I asked that is because, and I'm probably stretching quite a bit here, but I couldn't help but see David Lynch's whole career throughout this movie. And I feel like it's always dangerous to posit a direct influence, but the usage of industrial spaces as spiritual and supernatural, the use of sound and noise, making the common seem alien. It really cemented for me. There's a moment when Ayu's theoretical father shows up and the buzzer goes off, and it sounds exactly like the buzzer from Lost Highway. And I feel like this movie has similar filmic language.
Wow, that's interesting. I never thought of that. I have no information as whether Lynch ever saw these, but that's certainly, it's a possibility. He seems to like commercial films better in terms of what he draws on, but I have no idea. Lynch is also a major favorite of mine. I think Inland Empire is one of the greatest films of all time, but I don't know where you can't see a light bulb swinging from a ceiling without thinking of Lynch or a ceiling fan now, but I see what you mean.
Yeah, it may be just convergent evolution. I need to rewatch Inland Empire. It missed me, but I've come across it in so many other conversations and readings that it's clear to me I need to give it another shot.
When you do, make sure you get the set that has the deleted scenes. There's one deleted scene, for that scene alone should have gotten Laura Dern the Academy Award. It is the most amazing performance of a down and out woman talking to a social worker. I don't know why they didn't leave that in the film, but I really love that movie. I saw that again. I saw that in Korea too. And I remember being the only person in the audience awake by the end of the movie. Once again, don't trust me.
Oh, the only thing I'll say, and there's nowhere this will fit in, but I'm just going to say it. I kept thinking Angel Heart every time they showed the back of the factory with the fan moving.
Oh, wow. Like the elevator, yeah.
Yeah. I was watching that, and I'm like, oh, Harry Angel's in trouble again.
Wow. That's an interesting... I love to think about Angel Heart. That's another film that should have gotten a lot more attention than it did.
If we could just go back to Angel Heart and digitally remove the baby's yellow eyes in the final scene, it would play so much better.
Yeah, that's a good point.
All right, guys, let's go ahead and take a break and play a preview for next week's show right after these brief messages.
その入れ袋はこの階段だ。いかにも鬼じゃ。二度も鬼には女ら二人がいたしてくれたわ。
That's right. We conclude Japanese Month with a look at Toshio Matsumoto's Demons. Until then, I want to thank my co-hosts, Earl and Axel. Earl, what is the latest with you, sir?
I'm co-editing a book with David Desser on the films of Kinoshita Keisuke, who is one of my favorite directors. So that's a great honor for me. And I'm my own book on film theory and practice in Japan. I'm nearing the end of it, and I'm going to be giving a lecture and a roundtable about that book at the University of London in the summer. So I'm really excited to go to the UK.
I'm excited to read your book.
Thank you.
And Axel, how about yourself?
Busy as a dad, busy with work. I've got some fiction writings that I'm putzing around with. There's one novel I wouldn't mind sending out and another one that needs to be edited, and I'm dragging my heels on that part. I still have an idea for a podcast that I have blocked out in my head that I want to get started. I just need to actually, that doing it part, it turns out that's a big part of the podcast. Thinking about it is nice, but the actually doing the podcast, that's the real thing you got to do.
there is a little hump there that I got to get over. Thank you so much, guys, for being on the show. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you want to hear more of me shooting off my mouth, check out some of the other shows that I work on. They are all available at weirdingwaymedia.com. Thanks especially to our Patreon community. If you want to join the community, visit patreon.com/projectionbooth. Every donation we get helps the Projection Booth take over the world.